All right, today is Tuesday, October 15th. I'm going to start you all on page 83. So what we did in class on Thursday of last week, we did the parts of contraction. It is a process called the sliding filament theory. And then very end of class, we got a little bit into the excitement portion, which is how we tell the muscle cell that we want it to contract. So since we have the pieces, I'd like to put it all together and do it from the top this time and in the correct order. Starting off with excitation, which is just a fancy word for how we tell the muscle cell to be excited and prepare to contract. And excitation has to do with stimulating a muscle cell. So we'll walk through those concepts in just a moment. The second piece of this process is contraction, and that is muscle contraction. It involves a sliding filament process. We talked about that last class period as well. So I am going to take it this time in the correct order from excitation through contraction, and then we'll detail one more time that sliding filament theory. We can spend today on this. I don't want to keep going over it to the point that you are doing this in your sleep, but I want to do this often enough until you get this comfortable. So we can hit this process today. If you want to hit it again on Thursday and next week, we can come back to it until this stuff starts to click and make sense. This concept is not a flashcard-friendly concept. In fact, I would encourage you to find somebody who will listen to you talk through it. It's like telling a story. It's like saying, I drove up in the parking lot, I got out of my car, I shut the door, I went in the grocery store, I got a cart, I pushed the cart around. The first thing I went and picked up was milk. You know, I put that in my cart. It's a sequential process, just like that. So you want to be able to tell it as if it was a story in a sequential method. So that's one way that I would recommend studying this content. I'm going to hang here until y'all get through copying. Anybody else need the slide? Okay, so excitation is excitement. It's how we tell our muscle cell to contract. The important piece here is you do not want your muscle cells contracting all the time. You only want them to contract when you say so. So we have to have a way to tell the muscle cell now is an okay time to contract. So the word stimulate comes to mind when we mention excitation. The way we stimulate muscle cells is by using nerve cells to send a message to them. What we're looking at is a unit here. It's composed of a motor neuron, these little bud-like endings. What are those endings called? Axon terminals. And all the muscle cells stimulated by that one motor neuron. Together, this entire group of motor neuron and cells that are being stimulated is called a what? Motor unit, good. Now, if we were to look individually where the axon terminals stimulate individual muscle cells, this is a piece of a motor unit called a junction. What type of junction? Good, this is a neuromuscular junction, and it is the point at which an axon terminal comes in contact, or nearly comes in contact, with one of those muscle cells. So we talked in class last week about how the muscle cell and the nerve cell don't actually touch. There's a little bit of interstitial fluid between the two, and there's a gap of space between the muscle and the nerve cell. This gap of space is called what? Synaptic cleft, good. Okay, so let me take you to this picture here. There's a lot going on in this picture. And I'm going to start with the process of you deciding to pick up your pen and write. When your brain sends a message to your nerves, that nerve impulse travels down your nerves to the point where you get to the right motor unit. When we get to the motor unit, we send impulses down the length of those axon terminals. You'll notice right over here on the side is a special channel. And when the nerve impulse arrives, we call it an action potential here. That nerve impulse or excitement opens up that calcium channel. What happens next? What comes in through that channel? Yeah, calcium comes in, okay? So that little detail is important because calcium says to these vesicles, all these vesicles here full of acetylcholine, it's okay for you to release and exit out through the end of that axon terminal. All right, so let's do this again. When you decide to pick up your pen and write, the nerve impulse travels down a motor neuron to the appropriate motor unit. The nerve impulse travels into these axon terminals, and the impulse opens up calcium channels. Calcium rushes into your axon terminal from the, you know, interstitial space out here, and that tells these little vesicles full of neurotransmitter that it's okay to be released. So you'll notice they kind of pop here off the end of your axon terminal, and they do so by exocytosis. What does exocytosis tell us we're doing? Moving out. Yeah, you're exiting out the end of that axon terminal. So what is in each of these vesicles? Neurotransmitter, good. And what type of neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine, good. So when the nerve impulse arrives in the axon terminal, the calcium channel opens. Calcium flows into your axon terminal. The vesicles now leave by exocytosis. And once that acetylcholine is in your synaptic cleft, that acetylcholine now diffuses across to the membrane across the way, which is actually on a nerve or a muscle cell. So all of these little purple things sitting here, these are protein channels too, but these are specific for sodium ions. What does that acetylcholine molecule now do? Open the sodium channels. So you'll notice teeny tiny little green dots sitting there. That's the acetylcholine that binds to that sodium channel. That tells the sodium channel it's okay to open up. All right, so let's do this from the top. When the nerve impulse travels down the axon terminal, what type of channels open on your axon terminal?
Calcium.
Calcium, good. Calcium floods into your axon terminal, and what does that allow to happen next? Good, gonna release these vesicles of acetylcholine. Kind of like a little blister right there, popping off the end. And when acetylcholine travels into your synaptic cleft, what does it bind to next?
Sodium
channels, good. So when that sodium channel receives an acetylcholine, that sodium channel, you'll notice here, opens up. And as the name implies, sodium channels regulate sodium entry into the cell. Once it's opened, sodium floods into your muscle cell. If you have enough sodium flood into your muscle cell, what happens to your muscle cell? And right before contraction, we have excitation, right? So if you get enough sodium flooding in, then we have excited your muscle cell. That is where the story of excitation really kind of concludes, and it allows us to go to the next phase of the story, which is contraction. Okay, so let's do this one more time from the top. When we think about moving any body part, the nerve impulse travels from our brain down a set of nerves to the right motor unit, and the motor unit has these little bud-like endings called axon terminals. When the nerve impulse travels to the end of your axon terminal, the excitement there opens up calcium channels. What happens next? Calcium comes in, and vesicles full of what now may exit?
Acetylcholine,
good. What happens to acetylcholine in the synaptic cleft? Binds to the sodium channels, good. And as soon as it binds to a sodium channel, what happens to the channel? Opens up, good. And once that channel opens up, sodium floods into your muscle cell, and we now have
excitation,
good. So that is the first half of this process. Excitation means we have now stimulated your muscle cell. Now, we're going to finish this in just a moment. What do you do to that acetylcholine to stop it from opening those sodium channels? How do you get rid of it? There is an enzyme, good. And that enzyme is called ACHE, or acetylcholinesterase. And that enzyme will actually recycle those acetylcholines, send them back up into your axon terminal for storage. So if you want to stop the process, you've got to use the enzyme. It's called ACHE or acetylcholinesterase. It stops further unwanted muscle contractions. All right, are you so far so good? Okay. So we actually have done excitation 1, 2, we've done 3. And we've done 4 that we talked about the action potential. If you want to flip over to page 84, I'll help you label those parts. Potential or nerve impulse coming into this axon terminal. How would you describe what's happening in letter B?
Acetylcholine is released.
Good. Acetylcholine is released. Acetylcholine is released. I'm out of space here, but you'll notice in letter C, there's acetylcholine. What is it binding? Good. Letter C is acetylcholine binds a sodium channel. Letter C, acetylcholine binds a sodium channel. And letter D shows ions moving in. What type? Good. Letter D, sodium ions rush into your muscle cell. Letter D, sodium ions enter your muscle cell. There's a little more that happens here with this story that I'm not sharing right now. I think you've got enough up here to think about, right? When you get into the next chapter, which is 11 and nerve impulse transmission, I need to tell you about this whole issue with sodiums and potassiums. We'll talk more about the charge setup here and why sodiums rushing in actually make this an excitation event. So we'll save the details probably for... That's probably going to be either Thursday or Tuesday of next week. We'll get into those details. For now, we'll just say once the sodiums rush into your muscle cell, that influx of ions is going to create an excitement wave inside your muscle. All right. Now, just a side story here. If I want to stop muscle contraction, I have to stop the excitement. So what must we do to the acetylcholine? That enzyme turns it off, right? ACHE is going to come along. It will break down acetylcholine. And acetylcholinesterase, A-S-E, great way to remember it is an enzyme. It recycles those acetylcholines back up into the axon terminal. If you get rid of acetylcholine, what happens to that channel? it closes. And what happens to sodium ions? Can they come in?
No. Nope.
They can't come in anymore. So you shut their opportunity down. You shut their doorway. If you've heard of medications like uptake re-inhibitors or things of that sort, that's what acetylcholinesterase actually does, is it promotes uptake, not prevents it. So it promotes putting that acetylcholine back up here in these vesicles, because we recycle it and use it the next time there's another nerve impulse transmission. So this kind of goes along with what you may have heard in the psych class. Okay, so that should take care of the picture at the top of the page. Do you have any questions on that picture? Do you feel comfortable with excitation so far?
Better.
Better, okay. And we can do this again.
Yeah.
All right, let's head into contraction, which is down near the bottom of your page. Okay, a lot of terms here for us to review.
I want to show you this picture because in this picture, you'll notice the sarcoplasmic reticulum colored here in blue, and sitting right next to it is a T-tubule. These T-tubules are transverse tubules. They dive deep into your muscle cell and they carry the nerve impulse transmission into the insides of your muscle cell. So it's like zapping your muscle cell all at once with sodium, and that's what brings about the excitement in those muscle cells. Well, what we're actually trying to excite is this sarcoplasmic reticulum. What does it store?
Calcium,
good. And do you recall what the SR wraps around? SR wraps around a myofibril, so it's kind of like a lacy sleeve that wraps right around those contractile organelles. Okay, and by the way, your blank down there, page 84, is SR. That is short for sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there comes the excitement. There comes the wave of sodium ions into your muscle cell by way of these T-tubules. That excitement causes your SRs to release calcium. So just want to make a mental note here. This is the second time we've talked about calcium. The first time was up there at the axon terminal. Now we talk about it again here with this SR. So when you release calcium from your SR, that calcium travels to these pieces of your myofibril. What particular filament is it going to target?
Actin,
good. And where particularly is it going to bind on an actin filament?
Troponin,
good. So as soon as calcium binds troponin, there's a rope that moves out of the way. That rope is called?
Tropomyosin,
good. So when calcium comes out of your SR, it binds to troponin, and then the rope here of tropomyosin moves, now revealing your binding sites. Okay, so let's do this from the top. We are now talking about contraction, and contraction is going to begin when the excitement of the nerve impulse reaches the SR, and the SR releases stored what?
Calcium,
good. The calcium is going to come to one of these actin filaments and bind specifically to
troponin.
The rope-like tropomyosin moves, revealing what? Active binding sites. Good. So they're on that actin filament. Now that those binding sites are revealed, these myosin heads can reach up and form a what? A cross bridge. Good. And that's the last term on page 84 and the first term on 85. So let's flip over to 85. Well, we expect for that head, once it forms the cross bridge, to pivot, and pivoting is going to cause that filament to slide. Which filament will slide? The actin, right, the actin filament. So when this head binds to the thin filament and that head pivots, it's going to make that thin filament slide.
The pivoting of that head is called power stroke. Good. So this is a repetitive process. How do you get the head to release? Pay it off with an energy molecule known as ATP. Good. So the head relaxes. Those binding sites are still revealed. It's going to come up and attach, forming a cross bridge. It's going to pivot, doing a power stroke, and that pivoting is what's going to make your thin filament slide. This is rapid fire fast. So your head reaches and cross bridges. It pivots, causing a power stroke, making that whole thin filament slide. And then how do you get the head to release?
ATP.
So you do this over and over every time you do a muscle contraction. So if you think about how fast you move, this is happening in milliseconds, getting those thin filaments to slide. All right, so this is what we call the sliding filament theory. Literally, let me get you a different video here. We say those heads walk along and pull that thin filament past the thick ones. And the whole goal of doing this is to cause your muscle to shorten. So looking at our picture over here, what in particular will shorten about your myofibril?
What about this picture shortens? The sarcomere. Right, so the distance between these Z lines will be moved toward each other, and the sarcomere will shorten. So when you move Z lines closer together, what happens to your H zone? Disappears. Your I bands disappear as you butt those Z lines right up against the ends of our thick filaments. So I bands disappear. Does anything happen to the length of your thick or your thin filaments? They don't change length. The only thing that changes length is the distance between your Z lines. And of course, that results in a shortening of your muscle. So that is how you contract the muscle, as you make those thin filaments slide past each other. Alright, so I band disappears. That H zone disappears. So let's do contraction from the top. When the nerve impulse travels down one of these T-tubules, those T-tubules give the nerve impulse directly to the inside of your muscle. The excitement that it brings with having sodiums, you know, come rushing in, makes the SR release what? Good. SR releases calcium. When SR releases calcium, let's go over here to this picture. What does calcium bind to on your actin filament?
Troponin.
What happens next? Good. Tropomyosin rope moves out of the way. And now that we've revealed your binding sites, what happens to your myosin heads?
They attach.
They attach and cross bridge formation occurs. Good. That head pivots, forming a what?
Power stroke.
Good. So what does the power stroke accomplish? Contraction. Yeah, we're going to pull that thin filament. But we can't pull it so far, so we have to make the head release using ATP. And because the binding sites are still revealed, we cross bridge and power stroke, release, cross bridge, power stroke, and release until the muscle shortens, however short we say for it to shorten. So if I only want my muscle to move here, then I may not need to do it as much. Or if I'm moving it all the way, I may need to continue doing that power stroke process. At any rate, the walking along of these heads is called a sliding filament theory because we are technically causing those thin filaments to slide past the thick ones. So what particular portion of your myofibril actually shortens?
Sarcomere,
good. Thin filaments, thick filaments, do they change in length? They do not. All they do is slide, and then when it's time to relax, they go back to their resting state.
So speaking of relaxing, how do I stop this power stroke mechanism? I could cut off ATP, or how do I start the mechanism? So what do I do to the calcium to stop this mechanism? Put it back in my sarcoplasmic reticulum. If I get rid of the calcium from this mechanism, what happens to the rope of tropomyosin? It covers up and closes off those binding sites. So if the rope of tropomyosin is now covering the binding sites, is it possible for us to do cross bridges or power strokes? You're stuck. Yeah, you can't do it anymore. So if you want to stop this process, put the calcium up in the SR. The rope of tropomyosin will cover up those binding sites, and that's it. That's the end of your process because you've now stopped muscle contraction and you're back into a resting state. So actually that is detailed there below on your page. That's part of how we relax a muscle is you got to use acetylcholinesterase. You've got to restore the calcium back in the SR. You've got to cover up the binding sites on the troponin and tropomyosin complex. No more cross bridges, no more contraction. So basically, you just undo what you've been doing in order to get that muscle to head back to a relaxed state. I do want to mention up under excitation-contraction coupling, we have not yet talked about isotonic and isometric contractions. Let me show you what those are. Okay, so iso as a prefix means same. That's not really helpful because they both begin with iso. So what I have to do is look at the suffix of the word. Metric says to me a meter or a length. And so those kinds of contractions, isometric contractions, have the same length of muscle tissue as opposed to an isotonic contraction. So if I lean against the wall or, you know, think about standing, when you're using a muscle and not actually shortening the muscle, you're doing what's called an isometric contraction. Everything else is an isotonic contraction. So this picture kind of illustrates the difference. You'll notice isometric there on the left. This muscle actually has not yet changed length. As soon as it shortens, you've performed an isotonic contraction. Okay, so if you lean against a wall, you may feel your triceps and biceps bulk. That's because cross bridges are forming, but you're not actually shortening the muscle any. So if this wall was, say, cardboard, I could probably push it down, and then at that point you may feel the muscle change length. But otherwise, most contractions do produce a movement and are shorter. Those are isotonic contractions. Hey, not to be confused with hypotonic, hypertonic, isotonic of osmosis. This is totally different, but this basically is a muscle type of contraction. Isotonic produces shortened muscles. Isometrics don't change in length at all, so like leaning against a wall. Would you like to run through this from the top? Okay. Okay, so this is going to take us back to page 83 with excitation. All right, so excitation or excitement comes when a nerve impulse travels to a muscle cell and relays the excitement to the muscle cell. So we're looking at a motor unit here. It's composed of a neuron and all the muscle cells that are being stimulated. And we're going to zoom in on a very tight relationship between an axon terminal and the muscle cell. That little relationship is called what? Yeah, neuromuscular junction. The muscle and nerve technically do not touch. There is a gap of space between the two. We call it a synaptic cleft. Good. So as soon as you decide that you want to move a body part, whatever it is, the nerve impulse travels down a motor unit and to all of those axon terminals in that motor unit. The excitement or the nerve impulse that arrives in that axon terminal causes what type of channels to open? Calcium channels.
Now, when the calcium floods into your axon terminal, it tells these vesicles here that it's okay to exit. What do these vesicles hold? Acetylcholine. When the acetylcholine comes out into your synaptic cleft, what happens next? Good, it binds the sodium channel. And the sodium channel will now open. And the flooding of sodium into your muscle cell, that creates an atmosphere of excitement. Okay, so that's how we excite your muscle cell. We have to have enough sodium flood in, because if you only have just a small trickle, that may not be enough to cause excitement. That's something we'll talk about with nerve impulse transmission. Okay, so now let's kind of transition over to contraction. When your sodiums rush into your muscle cell, all of that excitement causes these sarcoplasmic reticulum, these here in blue, to release their stored ions. What are they?
Calcium.
Good. So when calcium is released, it comes to these actin filaments and binds what particular portion?
Troponin.
The binding of calcium to troponin will cause a rope of what to move?
Tropomyosin.
When tropomyosin moves, we now reveal binding sites, and those binding sites are going to allow what to come and attach?
Myosin
heads. And the special name for the attachment?
Crossbridge.
Crossbridge, good. Now, that head is going to pivot, and the pivoting of that head is going to pull that thin filament. The pivoting is called a what?
Power
stroke, good. We have to repeat this over and over, and how do you get the head to release so you can do it again?
ATP.
So you paid the head with ATP, it relaxes back. As long as those binding sites are sitting there, the head will pivot back, form a cross bridge, pivot with a power stroke, pay it off with ATP, and it relaxes again. So it's just doing this number where it's pulling your thin filament along constantly until you get the muscle shortened and a contraction to take place. Okay, so the name of the theory here that moves the muscle and causes contraction is called the what theory?
Sliding filament
theory. And when you're looking at a picture of a myofiber like here on the board, what is the only thing that shortens in that picture?
Sarcomere.
Good. What happens to your H zone?
Shrinks.
I band?
Disappears.
Anything happen to your thin or thick filaments?
Nope,
they're staying the same length. All right, so that's the second half of the story. That's contraction. So we've got a mess. Let's clean it up. If you want to stop excitement, you have to go back to this picture. What do you get rid of in this picture to stop excitement?
Acetylcholine.
So what will break down the acetylcholine?
ACHE.
That ACHE recycles the acetylcholine, and where does it go? Back in the axon terminal, right? So it just basically says, hey, you're done here, go home. So the acetylcholine breaks up into acetyl and choline, and it recycles back up into your axon terminal. When you do that, what happens to your sodium channel?
It shuts and closes.
So game over. There's no more excitement that's going to take place. So that starts an effect that will then tell the calcium to come back to your sarcoplasmic reticulum. And with no more calcium available for these binding sites on actin filaments, what happens here? Tropomyosin covers the binding sites. Can you do cross bridges anymore?
You're done,
right. So if you think about how fast you can muscle contract, relax, do it again, you can move within split seconds. So all of this process is split second fast. So that's incredible to think about all of this happening faster than we could possibly talk it through. Okay. I want to show you some stuff for fun, just to kind of let your brain relax a minute. Fast forward here for just a moment. I'll come back to that. So I'll talk about the word tetanus in just a moment, but I wanted to mention to you
couple of problems. You may have seen Black Widow spiders before. Step on them. Make sure you got a closed-toed shoe on when you step on them. In this state, it is one of two poisonous spiders. The other one is a brown recluse, which can cause like necrotizing fasciitis. It can like basically eat and kill your tissues. So the problem with this little bug here is, especially on the females, you've got this red hourglass on the belly, on the bottom side of the abdomen. You're not going to see it from the top side, but if you flip the spider over, I don't know how you're going to do that, but if you were to flip it over, you would see that red hourglass. Crazy thing, we were coming back in from the parking lot one day, and there was actually a dead one laying down back here in the parking lot. And, you know, being a science person, I'm like looking at every bug, everything that's out there. I was like, oh my gosh, dead, did not touch, Black Widow spider laying out there in the parking lot. So if this nasty thing bites you, it injects a neurotoxin that causes an increase in acetylcholine. So if you increase acetylcholine, let's just think about that. What happens to the sodium channels? They open and they stay open, and you've got lots and lots of sodium flooding in. And then what happens to this sliding filament mechanism?
It goes and goes.
It stays contracted, right. Unfortunately, people who get Black Widow spider bites may end up with pneumonia because sometimes their diaphragm doesn't work as well as it should. And so they can't breathe out and breathe in. And so fluid accumulates and they get like infections in their lungs. So that's probably a minor problem that could be a result of excess acetylcholine. Too much acetylcholine can also do this, lockjaw. So if somebody's ever told you don't walk in the yard barefoot, you could step on rusty nails, you're like, yeah, right, where would they ever be, right? No, you'll find them. And the problem is soil and rusty equipment oftentimes has an association with bacteria called Clostridium. And if you happen to puncture nails especially into your body, then you have a closed wound that cannot drain. So now you've got bacteria inside that cannot get out. And unfortunately, the bacterium produces a type of toxin that promotes lots of acetylcholine to be released. One of the first places we sense it is in the jaw area. So that masseter muscle would pick up excess acetylcholine. Once again, what happens to the excitement process? Yeah, acetylcholine stays bound to those sodium channels, sodium continues to flood in, and of course, what happens to your muscles? They contract and they don't relax, because as long as sodium is flooding into your muscle cell, the muscle cell says, yeah, I'm contracted. So unfortunately, that can cause writhing pain like you see here. The interesting thing is, you know, antibiotics have been around for, what, about 70, 80 years? And before that time period, if you happen to have this bacterium, then you could possibly die a very painful death. Unfortunately, it causes full body muscle spasms like you see here, contractions that makes the body, like, make these strange arches like you see. So if you happen to have been hit by a musket ball or gunshot that had Clostridium on it, this could be your painful death for the next 2 to 3 months. I want to say the lucky ones probably died from this. The ones who lived through it had 2 to 3 months of pain and these full-blown muscle contractions before their body killed the bacteria and they recovered. So I imagine those people probably never wanted anything to do with metal again if they knew where it came from. So nowadays we do have tetanus shots that can prevent the toxin from causing problems. And antibiotics can also do an after the, you know, exposure job of getting rid of the bacteria. Since we're also talking about too much, let's talk about too little acetylcholine. If you want to think about Botox injections, Botox will cause paralysis in muscles. So let's start at the source. Botox is going to cause a process here to shut down. What in particular? Sodium channels are open because you don't have enough acetylcholine. Yeah, so basically what Botox does is it says to these axial channels, don't release acetylcholine, so the acetylcholine doesn't come into your cleft, it doesn't bind your sodium channels, and the sodium channels don't open. So do muscles contract when Botox is present? Does not.
So if you want to paralyze your muscles, this is the way to do it, right, with Botox. The scary side effect of it is where they inject it, it can drift. So if you intend on having crow's feet or, you know, frown lines removed or temporarily paralyzed, the unfortunate thing is it can drift into your eye, cause paralysis in your eyelid. So, you know, just buyer beware if you happen to check out Botox someday. They use it for people that sweat profusely from the armpits. You know, if somebody has an excessive sweat issue, they can actually paralyze those sweat glands up under the armpits. So they can do it on the hands and feet too if you have excessive sweating there. And that was all my fun stuff. All right.
So how do you feel about pages 83 through 85 so far? I don't expect you to be at 100% at this point. Do you feel like you're at least a 5 out of 10 on comfort? Okay. Anybody kind of a 7 out of 10? Not quite. Okay. Not there yet. Okay. So if we're at 5 out of 10, that's a good place. What we can do is work through that again and again for the next couple of weeks till we get that comfortable. Okay. So why don't I head you to the bottom of page 85, a little bit on smooth muscle there. We know that smooth muscle is not striated, so you don't see all the same setup in smooth muscle that you do in say, cardiac or in skeletal muscle, but there is a similar type of sliding filament contraction process that makes smooth muscle contract. And the interesting thing is, smooth muscle can contract over longer periods of time without getting tired, and that's a good thing because you're moving urine through the urinary system. You're moving food through the digestive tract, blood through blood vessels, using all smooth muscle. So if it were to tire, then, you know, you'd be in trouble, yeah, especially with blood moving, right? So it is key here that this type of muscle does not tire over a longer period of time. The primary type of contraction that we see in smooth muscle is called peristalsis. How would you describe peristalsis? Squeezing a toothpaste tube, good. So, I know you've done this. If you've got a tube of toothpaste, you probably squeeze around the middle. That's how these circular muscles work. Sometimes when your toothpaste tube is running empty, you do what the longitudinal muscles do, the ones that run the length. You take your hand at the very end of your toothpaste tube and you milk it up toward the opening. So squeezing and milking. And that process moves food or blood or urine, whatever it is, along the length of that tube. So you can stand on your head, probably not the best idea, after a meal, and peristalsis will still move your food from one part of the organ to the next, just simply through these rhythmic contractions. Squeeze, relax, squeeze, relax. Of course, it takes a while to get to the exit point. Okay, so that is what I wanted to hit for you on the bottom of page 85. Those are probably two or three of the most heavy-duty pages we've hit so far this semester. I will come back to those. Do y'all have any questions before we move on to page 87? Oops, actually 88. You ever seen an EKG? Okay. Ever seen a fetal heart monitor? Okay. So these kinds of things measure electrical activity. And muscles, of course, have electrical activity thanks to the influx of what types of ions?
Sodium.
So when sodium floods into your muscle cell, it makes the environment really positive. And that positive environment is what changes the charge and makes the cell excited. So on page 88, we're going to talk about muscle tension, the graph that's pictured there, and how it's related to a muscle contraction. Okay, so first off, at the very top of your page, you'll notice that muscle tension is produced by cross bridges. So if you think about sitting in your chair, your back muscles have a mild state of constant nerve stimulation that makes the back muscles keep you in a constant state of slight tension. That's good news, right? What if there was no tension in your back muscles? You'd fall over. Exactly. So all of your muscles are operating in some level of constant tension. That means those cross bridges are forming in some places as isometric contractions and keeping those muscles slightly contracted and stabilized. If we want to increase the tension in a muscle, in other words, if we want to increase the amount of work the muscle can do, you'll notice there's something called a graded response. We can either increase the number of muscle cells being stimulated or change the frequency of the stimulation. So let me put it to you this way. If you're only picking up something that's a few ounces, I don't need a great amount of tension in these biceps and triceps muscles. But if I decided that this whole desk is something I'm going to pick up, I need to have more strength to pick up a heavier object than just something tiny. So what I can do is I can either get more muscles to contract at the same time, or my brain can stimulate, this is totally beyond my conscious control, my brain can stimulate those muscles faster and faster to make sure that they stay contracted to pick up something heavy. Okay, so let's talk through what you see in this picture. That'll help us understand how we can make muscles do more work, increasing that muscle tension. This is what we call a muscle twitch. You ever had one of these? Annoying as heck, right? Okay, so sometimes if you're stressed, you'll get them. Sometimes they'll stay for weeks or months. Sometimes if you're having sleep problems or if something else is going on in your life, these little twitches will come about. And they're totally not a normal way for muscles to work. They're an abnormal way because we normally don't need just one little motor unit to respond. We need them to respond in groups to do work. So you'll notice over here on the left side is tension, along the bottom is time, and we're dealing with milliseconds. This whole twitch occurs in less than a half of a second. So no wonder they annoy the heck out of you. They're like, blip, blip, so fast they make that muscle make a tiny contraction and that's it. Right here at time zero is a stimulus. So what is the stimulus? How do we tell that muscle cell, hey, get ready to contract? Nerve impulse. And what will that send across our synaptic cleft? Acetylcholine. And acetylcholine binds to sodium channels. And sodium channels will now open. And what happens next? Sodium goes in. Do you realize that all of that happened between zero and about 2 milliseconds? That's a lot happening in 2 milliseconds. But by the time sodium rushes in, that tells our SR to release what? Calcium. And of course, the release of calcium binds to those troponins, and the rope of tropomyosin now reveals those active sites. Cross bridges are formed, and what happens next? Good. Pivot the heads, make a power stroke, and then release it with ATP and do it again. So all of that is happening in this next portion called the contraction phase. That's a little longer, although it's still in the millisecond range. It's a little longer. So eventually, acetylcholinesterase comes along, and what does that do to the acetylcholine? Yep, sends it back up into that axon terminal. This job is over, so we now close our sodium channels. Calcium is stored inside your muscle cell, back in your what? Sarcoplasmic reticulum. And eventually the binding sites are covered up by tropomyosin and you are done. That relaxation phase takes a little longer, so eventually you've cleaned up all of what's been upset and this whole twitch is done. So still, the process of doing this stimulus to contraction to relaxation is less than a half of a second, quite a bit less than half of a second. So this is the stage that a muscle would experience if you stimulate it. It goes through a contraction, you peak up there with a high level of tension, and then relaxation, you lose that tension. So let me show you that in this format here. So muscle twitches are not the normal way for muscles to operate. They don't feel very good, they feel strange, and oftentimes you're not gonna feel them if you're starting to build the muscle contraction. You probably don't feel this either. This is what we call TREPI, and every one of these arrows is a stimulus. But do you notice, after the stimulus, what does the muscle have an opportunity to do?
Relax.
So we're not stimulating frequently enough in TREPI to get a full-blown muscle contraction. But watch here with this one. This one's called summation of twitches. It's also called unfused tetanus. Notice how we become more rapid fire with those stimuli. Our muscles have less opportunity now to do what? To relax. So when you're moving about, this is kind of where you're operating. You give your muscles a little chance to relax, although you don't feel it, but it's enough to keep your muscle from being in a full-blown, tightened-up contraction. This is uncomfortable. This is fused or complete tetanus. Notice the rapid-fire stimuli come so quickly, the frequency here is so fast, your muscle never has the opportunity to relax. So what happens to the tension in this one? It builds. So that means those myosin heads are bound up, it's cross bridges, and that muscle is locked up tight.
Is that like a muscle cramp?
It is a muscle cramp, yeah. So Charlie horse muscle cramp, you know, get you out of bed at night. That is fused tetanus. So a few minutes ago when I was showing you this picture, that is full, complete tetanus. That means all the acetylcholine is sitting on those sodium channels, and sodium just keeps flooding in, making that muscle stay contracted. So, like I mentioned, we operate here at unfused tetanus. Summation of twitches is what it's called. And we try not to get over here into this full-blown fused tetanus because that doesn't feel very nice. So back to the top of your page. In order to change the tension, we can either increase the frequency, which is what we're doing here. We're stimulating faster and faster. Or you can do what's called muscle recruitment. You can get other muscles to join the show. Let me show you how that works. So if you're picking up, like I said, something lightweight, then you may not need but one motor unit to help you out. But if I'm going to pick up this entire table and everything on it, I need to increase my motor units. What will that help me do? What if I recruit motor units to pick up a heavy object? How will that help me out?
Stronger.
Stronger, yeah. So instead of just turning on one set of motor units, like these red ones here, I can turn on all my motor units. That will increase my tension. That will make me stronger in what I'm picking up. If you've ever helped a friend move and you've carried boxes, you may have picked up one that's a little too heavy and you said, I'm going to drop this. Going to drop this, it's coming, I'm going to drop it, right? So at that point, what do you think your motor units are doing?
Giving up.
Yeah, so if you max out your motor units and you're using all of them to do a job, you can eventually cause them to tire and then they'll say, hey, I'm done, I'm turning off, and they will fail one by one by one. And you know this because you say, I'm going to drop this, right? And then eventually the last motor unit fails and you can't carry it anymore, so you do drop your item. Most of the time, if you're carrying a load that you can handle, like, you know, a moderately heavy box, then these motor units will turn on and turn off and turn on and turn off until you can manage the load. So you don't necessarily feel like you have a sense of dropping that load. So going back to the top of the page, there's two ways to make your muscles stronger. One is you can increase the frequency of stimulation, which is just what we saw here. You can zap the muscle faster and faster till you get it closer to full-blown tetanus, or you can do the other one there. You can increase the number of motor units that you stimulate. The more motor units you turn on, the stronger the contraction or the higher that tension is going to be. Okay, so I did leave for you a pretty fancy looking myogram on the top of page 89. Kind of looks like the one we covered, and you'll notice the red arrows along the bottom of that picture, if you have it printed in color, Those are the stimuli. Those are acetylcholines binding those sodium channels. All right, so do you have any questions so far on tension, myograms? Put you a little star beside that picture. There is one of those on the test, that top of 89 picture. The bottom of the page is just fun stuff. It is not on your test. But I thought I'd mention something to you that's really fun, and that is fast and slow twitch fibers. Like I said, not on your test, just something to read. But if you've ever wondered about light meat and dark meat chicken, this is for you. So we actually have light meat and dark meat, and it has nothing to do with anything except for the amount of oxygen that your muscles can store. So if you're storing oxygen in your muscle tissue, you have dark meat fibers. And these are called slow twitch fibers. So if you prefer dark chicken meat, it's actually just a type of meat that stores oxygen, and it can twitch over a longer period of time. So if you stand up for a long time at your job, and I know if you're going into the medical field, that's going to be part of your life, right? Then you're going to really exercise those slow twitch fibers. These slow twitch fibers have steady power, they have endurance. These are what marathon runners use, are slow twitch fibers. They're the dark fibers. The fast twitch fibers, you'll notice, have explosive power. They tire easily. They're actually bigger in diameter. You can see they're actually bigger. And they're what we call white meat or light meat in chicken. And if you're the kind of person who's up and down all day, sometimes you're sitting, sometimes you're up, you know, running, then you're sitting again, this kind of explosive energy is what we need in a fast twitch fiber. So a sprinter is actually going to need the fast twitch. A marathon runner is going to need the slow twitch fibers. Depending on what you do for a living, you know, whether or not you stand all day or whether you are about in bits and spurts, you can actually exercise one type of fiber over the other. So if you go to work and you're doing nursing and you're standing on your legs, you may come home with aching legs and aching back for the first few weeks or even first few months. But once you build up those slow twitch fibers, then you should be more accustomed to that kind of standing lifestyle. So I thought that'd be interesting to share, since we often talk about white meat and dark meat and chicken. It's the same thing. It's slow twitch and fast twitch fibers. Last two words down there, hypertrophy and atrophy. As you might imagine, that's just enlargement of muscles through exercise, hypertrophy. And atrophy is the loss of muscle tone, exactly what occurs when you place a bone in a cast, muscle atrophy. How about any questions on that information? That is, that top of 89. That I'll ask you. I'll just ask you, like, which one is a twitch? I'll put ABCD across them, or which one's full-blown tetanus? So just being able to identify which one is which. Do y'all have any other questions so far? Let's see, the next page is 90, and it talks about three pathways for generating ATP in muscle tissue. All right, so the first thing I want to do is introduce ATP to you, and we know that ATP is an energy molecule. Let's dive a little deeper than that. We know that ATP is adenosine triphosphate. How many phosphates? Three. Okay, so when you've got ATP with the three phosphates, that molecule can do work. It's like somebody giving you a loaded debit card and said, okay, you can go make purchases. You've got a full debit card. Now, when you've depleted your debit card and there's nothing left on it, then you have the low energy form, which is called ADP. And ADP, diphosphate, means there's only two phosphate molecules on that whole arrangement. So the best thing to have is a full debit card, right? You want to have 3 phosphates. That allows you to do work in the body. That's an energy molecule that we can actually spend like currency or money. The low energy form is like having an empty debit card. That's ADP. And we really need to put money back on our card if we're going to do anything with ADP. So down here at the bottom of the picture is ADP. Diphosphate means you have no money on your debit card. And what we need to do is power it back up with a phosphate molecule. That phosphate molecule is going to give me 1 more phosphate, and that will give me, once again, ATP. So on this page, there are 3 ways to make ATP from ADP. Okay, so which is my preferred form for energy currency? ATP, right, with the 3 phosphates. So here's 3 ways that I can make the high, the spendable form of ATP. The first one there is aerobic respiration. You're doing this right now. You're taking glucose in your bloodstream from foods that you may have eaten today or yesterday, and you're breathing. You're bringing in oxygen, and that oxygen and glucose go to your mitochondria. The mitochondria is your powerhouse, and it turns those 2 ingredients, glucose and oxygen, into ATP. Okay? So there's a process by which we actually take a phosphate and we add it on. We phosphorylate, you might say, an ADP molecule, giving us ATP. So the bottom line is, this is actually a good way to do it. You get pretty good bang for your buck. Per every glucose molecule that you send through the mitochondria, you can make around 36 ATPs. So if this was gas mileage, I would say this is probably the best we can do in terms of making ATP molecules. All of us are doing it right now. We're all resting. Nobody's exercising in here. So at rest, you're going to make around 36 ATPs per glucose molecule. Just want to make a point here. Why do they call it aerobic respiration? Oxygen, right? So notice oxygen is an ingredient. Glucose and oxygen make those 36 ATPs. Okay. If you get up and start moving a little bit, you have a molecule sitting in your muscles that's waiting to give you a little energy boost. And that molecule is called creatine phosphate. There's a clue in phosphate, right? So creatine phosphate gives you about a 15-second boost. That phosphate molecule is stolen away from creatine. It joins with ADP. And what does that make for you? Makes ATP. Is this good gas mileage? You get 1 ATP for every creatine phosphate that you spend. So you borrow that phosphate, you join it with your ADPs, you only get 1. So this is not a great way to make ATP. So the minute that you start moving about, you start supplementing with this creatine phosphate. You might have heard of creatinine, which comes out in your urine. That is a waste product of doing this kind of creatine phosphate, direct phosphorylation is what they call it, of ADP. So as soon as you get up in this classroom today and you're leaving and you're packing your book bag, you have about 10 to 15 seconds of CP that help to generate some energy for you. After that, if you continue to move quickly and briskly, you need another way to help give yourself some ATP. So after about 15 seconds, your ATP reserve supplies are gone, and now you transition into step 3, which is anaerobic cellular respiration. So is this a good way to make ATP in terms of efficiency? You get 2 ATPs. That's pretty awful, right? Okay. So when you're doing anaerobic respiration, what are you not using to make the ATPs? Oxygen. You're not using oxygen, thus the name anaerobic. So you're breaking down glucose by itself, and that's a term we call glycolysis. Okay. What does glyco as a prefix tell us?
Sugar.
And lysis?
Break down.
So technically, anaerobic respiration takes sugar, breaks it down. There's no oxygen available. So it's not a very efficient process. All right, so this particular process can also produce a nasty little side effect, lactic acid. And if you've ever been exercising and had your muscles start to ache and burn, that's the lactic acid that's building up. And it takes a few days for that lactic acid to be destroyed by your liver. It can be used to regenerate more aerobic respiration, but excess, of course, can make your muscles ache and burn after exercise. So you're going to be breathing heavier as long as you're in anaerobic respiration because you're trying to get back to which more efficient process? Aerobic. Yeah, the first one, number one. So why is that the process you want to be getting back to? Yeah, number one on the list makes 36 ATPs for you. So you want to get the oxygen in so you can make the best bang for your buck. Okay, but if you want to lose weight, that's the way to go. Because when you're doing heavy duty work and you're sweating and you're breathing heavily, then you're performing anaerobic respiration. You're burning off glucose. Yeah, you're hopefully going to burn the fat next, right? But this way you're going to help to burn off more glucose because it's not a very efficient way to make ATPs. Okay, so I'll let you complete the little questions there. I'll give you a moment to fill those out. There's about 6 bullet points midway of your page. Okay, so what makes the most ATP on this list?
Aerobic.
Aerobic, yeah, number one. And makes the least? Good, direct phosphorylation. That's using that creatine phosphate or CP. Which process makes painful lactic acid?
Anaerobic,
good. That's number three in our list. And that's also the answer for our next question. Turns glycogen into glucose into ATP. That is anaerobic once again. What type of muscle generation or ATP generation is used to give you energy during rest?
Aerobic,
good. And during heavy exercise? Anaerobic. Just a couple of things to wrap up that page. Muscle fatigue at the very bottom. Muscles need blood, oxygen, ATP, and they need to not be damaged in order to operate properly. If you have any kind of problem with one of these resources, then your muscles become fatigued and they just won't react to the stimulus. You may have seen people cross the finish line at a marathon and they collapse. They may have finally hit the point where they have depleted one of these reserves. So even when your brain says to make the muscle contract, it may not respond. And so muscle fatigue and a non-response is just going to be the end result. Oxygen debt is the very last thing on that page. And if you're exercising and not breathing properly, it's got a fancy name. It's called EPOC, or post-exercise oxygen consumption. This is basically oxygen debt. And if you've ever played in a sport or participated in a sport, they've often said to you, make sure you breathe properly, right? Because if you don't breathe when you're exercising, you don't get the oxygen to your muscle cells to make ATP. Mm-hmm. So anytime that you're exercising, you're going to breathe hard to repay your debt, and you're going to continue breathing hard until you've repaid your oxygen debt. So if you do climb the stairs in this building, you have had oxygen debt down at the bottom of the page, and you're going to breathe hard until you get back into your aerobic respiration pattern. So what I'd like to do on Thursday is redo excitation contraction coupling. We'll do that until you feel comfortable. And then I'll probably start on page 92 with chapter 11.